Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of February the 3rd, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, giving today's session from here in Phoenix, and we're going to talk about a few cases and issues that developed during the past week in the area of federal taxes. We'll talk a bit about a statement made by a CID officer from Los Angeles regarding what the CID may expect to do with that question that's being asked on Schedule 1 of Form 1040 regarding virtual currency. We'll go into Section 195 for startup expenses and how that came to be a problem for a taxpayer. We'll also take a look at an argument a taxpayer had trying to argue that they were able to write off what they saw was an intangible that related to synergistic benefits, which the IRS decided that actually there was no such thing allowed under the law. They said it ended up being just a benefit to the corporation. And then we have two cases from the Western District of Wisconsin, U.S. District Court, Western District of Wisconsin, which we probably mentioned it over the years here on this podcast, going back all the time we've done it for all the years, which goes back, I think, back to about 2007 or 2008, we first started recording this. My first time, that was with Lynn Nichols and Mike Mayers at the time. And I'm sure some of us, at some point, we talked about this particular issue, this court, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin, but it's not the thing you normally pick up. It's not like the tax court. But this week, we'll have two separate cases that are impacted from that court. We'll talk about a question regarding the claim of right doctrine, which is an unusual thing that we run into from time to time in practice. And secondly, we'll discuss a case where the court rendered a decision, and then suddenly the taxpayer and the IRS came back and said, turns out we missed something, like a regulation that would have totally decided the case in a manner opposite to the way it finally got decided. And so can you please go back and reconsider your decision? Because turns out that it's without question an error. Interesting case. We'll talk about that. I did finish up this week my final live session, shall we say, where I'm in front of a group. So I have no more of that scheduled at this point until we get outside of tax season. But we do still have a few of these Cal CPA broadcasts that will take place. And actually, a couple of them even go on after the 15th of February. We got a number coming up before the 15th of February. Just want to highlight a few. Coming up on February 5th, I will have Protecting Tax Information, Cybersecurity for the Tax Professionals. That will be a four-hour course. It will begin at 8 a.m. Pacific time. You can get it there. Also, February 12th, Real Estate Partnerships, Get In, Get Out, Get Taxed. That's an 8-hour session. We'll begin at 6 a.m. Pacific and 8 a.m. Pacific, as well as on February 14th, S Corporations Advance Issued, also an 8-hour course beginning at 6 a.m. Pacific and 8 a.m. Pacific. We do have links for all of these courses on the website, Current Federal Tax Developments website. If you go to our upcoming courses, I now have links to the upcoming Cal CPA courses into their website, because it's not the easiest to find these things inside the California website. There are like two ways you'll bring up CPE, and one way it's really been fun for try to find the course, and some people have had trouble, so I've given it there. As well, don't forget your state society may very well offer these courses on their website. And if they do, that's usually the better way to go in and get it, because as a member of your state society, you will qualify for the member price for the course instead of having to pay the non-member price. But all of these are available. They are going to be broadcast. They qualify for NASBA credit, so you can qualify, get yourself for your CPE. You should qualify in virtually every state. So if you want to come over, cover those topics, the nice four-hour one on cybersecurity, or you want to cover the 8-hour sessions, and we do have a couple of other sessions coming up. I just highlighted these, so take a look online, and you'll see what courses we have coming up now with our Cal CPA rebroadcast. These are kind of the final things we can do state society level until we get past April 15th. Let's go to our first issue this week, which was an article that Tax Notes Today published on the 30th of January. Written by Wesley Elmore, it was talking about some statements made by an IRS CID agent in charge of the office in Los Angeles regarding what the IRS plans to do with that question they are asking on Schedule 1, Form 1040, about whether your taxpayer had anything to do with virtual currencies this year. That question was added late this last year in the draft. Remember, the first draft of Schedule 1 did not have this question, but as the IRS ramped up its cryptocurrency attention during the year, issued those letters, and also issued a new revenue ruling, we ended up getting this question added to Schedule 1 asking taxpayers, do you have any cryptocurrency or virtual currencies that you have acquired? Have you sold? Have you exchanged any? That question is going to be at the top of Schedule 1. And at the time when it came up, I speculated that the IRS is probably looking at this as a way to trap people into effectively committing perjury on the 1040. And the special agent of the Los Angeles CID, who was speaking in Southern California, basically confirmed this fact. This special agent, Ryan Corner, what he confirmed was that essentially talked about what might the IRS do with this, and more specifically, what might the Criminal Investigation Division do with this information. And not surprisingly, he said, well, an obvious use would be, we know some taxpayers who have had cryptocurrency transactions, and those transactions do not appear to have been on their return. Now, if we learn about these, we know this is going on, and if the taxpayer this year answers that question no, then suddenly you've actually made it much easier for the service to prove that you were trying to evade the tax. You went ahead and you misled them. You said you didn't have any of this when we in fact know you did. Now we discover that you'd also admitted income from this stuff, which is going to be the key. And suddenly, you know, hey, the IRS is going to claim, Department of Justice will claim, hey, that's evidence tax evasion. The IRS, of course, has had success on this on the Schedule B questions, but there we're looking at the civil willful failure to file penalty. And it is a higher standard than preponderance of evidence that you carry in this case. And the IRS, and they've been very clear that it's not a criminal level proof that goes on there. So whether this actually works, and I suspect it does not by itself in the criminal area, though not being a criminal attorney, I will not, you know, not being an attorney per se, attorney at all, I'm going to say I'm not going to basically say I'm able to really speak to that totally. But it does seem like it'll do a very good job of setting the IRS to at least get the civil fraud penalty from taxpayers who have failed to report their cryptocurrency transactions beginning in 2020 or 2019, when they're going to have lied on the return and essentially covered up. And that's going to be one of the demonstrations that the IRS will use to, at a minimum, be able to get that civil penalty. So it's really important that our clients answer that question, that we get that answer from them. Because remember, in the Schedule B cases, taxpayers have had no success arguing that, well, you know, I didn't pay any attention to that. I didn't answer that on the organizer. I didn't know it was there. I never read the organizer. I never looked at the return, so I didn't even know that question was on there. The courts have rejected that entirely, saying, sorry, taxpayer, you are responsible for what's on your return, and you have responsibility to read the return. When you signed the juror, you said you basically everything on the return was true and correct as far as you knew. And since it takes no special skills to know that when we ask you if you have virtual currency, that you know, 1,000,002 of Bitcoin you have sitting there in Coinbase, that counts, and it probably has a tax impact. So, yeah, that will be helpful in proving civil fraud to prove an intent to evade the tax to mislead the government. So be sure you get that question answered by your clients this year. Well, here's a case for a taxpayer, Provitola, U.S. Tax Court bench opinion. Now, this is unusual. You know, it's really kind of a sub-published opinion. It is available on the U.S. Tax Court site, but it's not a published, it's not even a small case opinion. It's not the published opinion. It's not a memo opinion. It's not the small case opinion. It's a simple bench opinion. And it's cases numbers 12357-16 and 16168-17. And this opinion was issued on January 24th. And what it looks at here is a case that's something we need to worry about. Under Section 195, a taxpayer who is expending money in a way that would normally be deductible as a trade or business expense, but he's doing this for a trade or business that has not yet commenced, those are considered startup expenses. Startup expenses cannot be deducted currently. Rather, they are held and only when we commence the business. are we able to claim that deduction? And this would turn around to really bite this taxpayer, because the IRS's initial challenge was that this taxpayer was paying money from a Schedule C business on the 1040 to his S corporation law firm for fees incurred for the Schedule C. The IRS tried to claim that entire transaction was a sham. The taxpayer won on that, but the court said, but nevertheless, the actual amount you're paying are startup expenses. So while they may be eventually deductible, you're not going to get them now. The taxpayer was it's kind of interesting, has a physics bachelor's degree, plus he's an attorney. And he had developed an idea that related to, in his view, I guess, would revolutionize the watching of television. And in fact, over time, he got 7 patents in this area as he worked to develop this project over a number of years. After a few years, he basically began charging his law firm, right, for expenses related to this, which I would assume would include the legal expenses for the various patents, but other expenses. He was running all the expenses essentially through the law firm. So he was paying fees to the law firm, right, for his services. And he was then deducting those fees. Again, they're on the S corporate term. He was then deducting those fees on Schedule C. Now, the IRS tried to claim the whole thing was a sham. And we don't really know enough to know why the IRS wanted to go that route, because, you know, it seems kind of circular, right? We would have this deduction on Schedule C. We'd have the income in the S corp. They're both flowing to his personal return. So it almost becomes a what's the difference? And his Schedule C is losing money, as we would discover. So it's not that we're saving self-employment tax. In fact, we're putting money into the S corp, which probably we're paying out of salary, which, you know, it's like, it doesn't seem like we're saving anything. You know, so it seemed unusual. I'm going to assume that somehow maybe he was funding a retirement benefit. He was getting some benefit, I presume, from having that income in the S corp, which is what he was going for. And so the wonderful part was the IRS said, oh, the whole thing's a sham. They tried to argue on exam that the money had never been paid. Turns out, no question, it had been. So then they turned around and said, well, it's just a sham, right? There's nothing really going on. The court said, no, we see this. I mean, he got 7 patents. He's actually developing this thing. He has the expertise. It's like, there's real things happening here. So all of this stuff is real. But that turned out to be a problem for the taxpayer, because the court said, here's your problem. Because your business of this, because the company, while they had actually built some product, they had not yet done any marketing. They had no sales. They had not yet attempted to sell this product. They had it in the warehouse, but they hadn't yet actually done anything to sell the products. They had built like the 1,100 of these units, but they hadn't actually done anything yet to try to sell them. So the court said, well, your problem is the fees are taxable at the S corp level, because you paid the S corp for services. The S corp rendered those services, and that's fine. That's taxable income. But there is no current deduction for the Schedule C. Those have to be held, and you're not going to deduct any of those expenses until you actually begin the business of this, you know, invention and marketing it, which you hadn't even done by the time we got to tax court. Forget the years under exam. He'd done anything by the time they actually got to try the case in court. So this is one where he won one, but it actually probably made his loss bigger. In terms of when he finally ended up losing on the other issue, that actually made for a bigger assessment most likely than if he had just won on the whole sham, because the IRS, the tax court did point out that if the transaction was a sham, that the IRS had to then reduce the income on the S side, which they hadn't done. So he'd probably been better off had the IRS won the first issue. Didn't happen. Key takeaway, be aware of this business startup expense. Clients always think that if they're going to go into a new business, that the minute they start incurring expenses, they get a deduction. That's not true. You have to show that they are actually ready and able to accept business. They have to do the things to be able to go after that business. They don't necessarily need revenue, but they do need to be in a position to generate some revenue. And when they're not, as in this case, because they haven't even tried yet, those expenses won't yet be deductible. Well, another case, this one is one where a taxpayer tried to argue that they had this intangible that they wanted to write off. What had happened in this case, and this is TAM, TAM 2020-04-010, Technical Advice Memorandum, issued on January the 24th of 2020. A while back, the parent company had acquired a sub, right? Now, in that acquisition, the sub had incurred a number of expenses in part of that transaction when the parent was acquiring its interest. And the sub had capitalized those expenses. Now, a few years later, the parent decides that it wants to get rid of the sub. It decides that that no longer makes sense. It's going to get rid of that company and sell it off. So the catch becomes at this point, now the subsidiary, they have all these costs on their balance sheet that related to that transaction to be acquired by a parent who's now dumping them onto a new buyer. And the sub says, well, you know what? I think that represented the expected benefit of synergy from having this parent as our owner. And because of that synergistic benefit, we're going to lose that because the parent's dumping us. We're no longer there. So since we're no longer there and since the synergy's gone, we think we should be able to write that off. So they did. It was written off before the sale. And of course, it flowed through on the consolidated return, which means effectively the parent got to take a deduction for this. Now, the IRS disputed that was possible. The IRS on exam says, no, there is no special benefit. You have no right to set up this asset as a benefit from synergy. And they're saying you don't meet the requirements under the regulations, which the taxpayer agreed on. There was no easily separately identifiable asset that they could point to that this represented. But they said, still, we should be able to set this thing up. The TAM says, no, these are the general fees discussed in the regulations under 263 little a, very similar to the fees incurred in Indopco, that essentially are of a general corporate benefit to the company. That benefit was a benefit to the sub in general. And because of that, it has to stay capitalized until we essentially get rid of the company entirely, shut down entirely. And they also said, secondly, even if it had been a separate intangible, you haven't shown me that, in fact, there was no value. You know, the mere fact that the parent decided to sell the company does not mean there is no value inherent in that, you know, benefits. Remember, we got a new buyer. We may be transferring this benefit now to the new buyer. You hadn't even proven, if there was such a thing, that it had become worthless, which was another requirement for you to write this thing off. So because of that, the TAM concludes, can't write it off, disallow the deduction. Again, it's a technical advice memorandum, so officially it only applies to this case, and officially, even in this case, they could always pay the tax, sue for refund. Again, we're not likely to win this case at, you know, basically, obviously the agent's going to follow the TAM. Appeals is going to follow the TAM. So we're probably, you know, we got to go to court. That's going to be expensive. Always kind of interesting, and TAMs are kind of dangerous. They're great if you're sure you're going to win. But agreeing to let something go to TAMs, if you're not sure you're going to win, or at least if you can't accept losing, may not be the best approach, right? So as I said, problem there, we've got it. Now let's start going to our Western District of Wisconsin cases. And the first one for this week is a case of Heiding versus United States from the Western District, U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin, case number 3:19-CV00224. The opinion was issued on January 23, 2020. This involves the thing known as the Claim of Right Doctrine. The Claim of Right rules under 1341A. Under 1341A, you can invoke relief under the claim of right if an item was included in gross income for a prior taxable year or years because it appeared the taxpayer had an unrestricted right to such item, and there is a deduction allowed for the taxable year in question, essentially that it was established after the close of that prior year, that we didn't have that unrestricted right, and the amount in question exceeds $3,000. What happened in this case is a little different, right? The Heidings had established a revocable grantor trust, right? Probably a standard revocable living trust. They had appointed a bank as custodian, right? This bank as custodian had turned around and sold certain stock that was held in the revocable living trust. Now, the problem was that the trust specifically provided that this stock, these two stocks, could not be sold while they were in trust. So the trustee had violated the requirement in the trust document not to sell these stocks. This problem wasn't noticed until after the end of the year. And the catch is, this sale resulted in a taxable gain of over $5.6 million. These sales did. And what's actually somewhat amusing is one of the stocks sold was a stock of the bank, of the very bank that was a trustee. So it's kind of a somewhat, shall we say, amusing situation. I'm sure they didn't have much amusement with it, but it was an issue. So the trustee notices this. Early in 2016, the trustee decides, I've got to go buy it back. I've got to get those stocks back. So the trustee went back and bought back the stocks. Now, the taxpayer was trying to argue that the cost of paying it back should be deductible to them as a loss with a recovery under claim of right. They were not arguing they didn't pick up the gain the prior year. They did. It was a grantor trust. They picked up the gain. But they said we should be able to recover the tax we paid by taking a deduction this year for that gain, for the amount of that gain, because the money was put back, creating a loss this year that we should be able to offset against that purchase of the stock. The court didn't agree. The court said, here's the problem. There is no legal requirement under Wisconsin law for these funds to be recorded. They said there were two problems. Problem one, it was a revocable trust. Before the trustee bought the stock back, they could have revoked the trust and walked off with the cash. Secondly, they said the beneficiary of the trust under Wisconsin law has the right to give approval to a transaction that's already occurred, the trustee did, even if it violates terms of the trust in this case. So they could have just approved what the trustee did. They said, so there was no, it's not as if you had no right to the funds. You had a right to the funds. You could kept the funds. You chose not to. And the court pointed out that shortly after this, I'm sure they weren't happy with the bank. Shortly after the bank bought the stock back, the couple basically revoked the trust and took all the assets back. The court said, look, you could have done that before the buyback. So because of that, this does not qualify as a claim of right issue. So you're not allowed to claim the deduction in the year of sale, or basically the year of purchase, to offset that prior gain. Now, this was interesting because they were claiming the deduction. The alternative under claim of right under 1341 is you can go back in the year you paid the tax and figure out how much extra tax you paid and then claim a credit on against the prior farther year's tax, the year you pay it back. I'm going to presume in this case that the deduction would have been worth more than the credit. Or potentially, I haven't looked at Wisconsin law, it's possible that under Wisconsin's tax law that they wouldn't recognize a claim of right credit, that you have to take the deduction in order for the claim of right to be recognized. And that's possible in some state laws too. So for whatever it's worth, they were trying to claim both. In this case, the court found, sorry guys, no claim of right. You can't claim that deduction. Now let's go on to an interesting case, which is a United States notice of non-opposition to a plaintiff's motion for reconsideration in the case of Harrison versus the Internal Revenue Service. This came again from the U.S. District Court from the Western District of Wisconsin. This was case 3:19 CV 00194 WMC, issued on January 24, 2020. And this particular case had been originally decided, essentially, back on January, let me get my right date here, originally decided, I believe it was like January 6th or 15th, I guess, right? One of these things. That was a motion for reconsideration. The actual case was decided a few days before that. Here's the catch. This case revolved around a taxpayer had filed their tax return late. And they had kind of not gotten around. They had a refund, over $7,000 refund that would be due, but they hadn't filed the return. They had filed for an extension of time to file the original return, but they just hadn't filed it. Now we're getting close to 3 years from October 15th. Okay? Now, remember, under the rules, if they, for the claim for refund, for them to be able to get a refund, they would have to file this claim before those 3 years are up, right? And there is a special rule that lets them come out to the extended due date if they filed for an extension, which they did. But the problem they've got is, you know, obviously it had to be filed before October 15th. They mailed in their return on October the 11th. Everybody agrees the envelope containing their return was postmarked on October the 11th. However, it arrived at the IRS on October 17th. That's also not anything under dispute. The question became in this case, we all know about the postmark rule on 7502A. And the question became, does that apply to a late filed return? And that actually been a matter of dispute for years, with the IRS claiming for many years that a late filed return could not take advantage of the postmark rule. So what they would say in this case is what would matter is not when that amended return was mailed, but when did it actually arrive at the IRS, meaning that essentially that return should have been walked in if you're under that rule, because you can't use a mailing rule. Or you should have used some sort of overnight delivery to have gotten it to them on October 12th. So you knew you were ahead of the game because you couldn't use the postmark. The postmark wouldn't help you. And that issue was disputed. The IRS denied the claim for refund, right? Said, sorry, took a look at your return. Wonderful. You say you overpaid us by seven some grand. We actually agree you did that. But sorry, came in too late. We're not going to pay the refund. We don't know if they were represented at that point or not by CPA, EA, counsel, or whoever at that point in time, but we do know the IRS denied it. And we know that the taxpayers claimed, as they're trying to fight this, that that basically 7805A standard postmark language in the code should cover their individual returns, even though they were late filed. Now, the interesting part about this was the taxpayer's attorney, when he filed suit, he also appears to have only mentioned this particular rule in the code, never cites regs in this area, and doesn't cite cases. The IRS cites a series of cases which they claimed showed that the courts had always ruled that you had to get it delivered. Now, the IRS apparently themselves internally never found a case called Weisbart. Weisbart was a case in the Second Circuit that held that you actually had to count the postmark date for this rule, even on a late filed return. So under Weisbart, the taxpayer's return should have been timely. Now, the Justice Department, they're the people that tried this case because it was in a district court. Department of Justice attorneys, again, IRS attorneys didn't tell them about this case, but the Department of Justice attorneys became aware of Weisbart. However, what they noticed on Weisbart was it was a Second Circuit case, and Wisconsin's not in the Second Circuit. So they decided, well, since it's not directly related to this case, there's no Seventh Circuit case that says this does, that basically that it's timely filing if it's postmarked, we're just going to ignore that case. Now, that comes back to haunt them in a couple of ways. So the opinion gets published. It says no. Now, here comes the problem. Regulation 301-7502-1F very clearly says late filed returns get the postmark rule. Okay, it's a reg that would be binding on Treasury. Therefore, the decision is clearly contrary to the reg, and the court should have decided it based on the reg. Now, the judge was never told about this reg by either side. And Weisbart wasn't apparently noticed by counsel for the taxpayer, wasn't noticed by IRS internally, was noticed by Department of Justice, but they stopped their analysis after looking at whether or not the case in question would have been applicable in the Seventh Circuit. So here comes the problem. Nobody took a look. First rule of tax law, of tax research. Again, all tax law is going to be decided. If it's not a constitutional issue, which it's not in this case, if it's not constitutional and there's not a treaty, treaties aren't involved, then code's your starting point for everything, which is fine. Taxpayers clearly started with code. But the problem is code is allowed to be interpreted by the service by regs. Now, regs are frustrating because they aren't always updated quickly when laws change. In fact, they stay around forever, and sometimes they're cross-referenced, so they actually discuss a law that doesn't exist, but because the regs cross-reference somewhere else, they have to leave it there. So regs can be very, very frustrating to deal with. But nevertheless, if a reg is current and interprets a section under the Mayo decision, if the section is ambiguous, and we're going to come down to the fact that it's not clear whether 7502A should or shouldn't cover this. We actually can take the point it is ambiguous. But if the reg clearly establishes the answer, then we follow the reg. And certainly, even for people that think that that's going too far, that agencies shouldn't have that much power, they would all tend to agree that if an agency publishes a reg, the agency at least is bound by it. In this case, it's the agency we've got the issue here with. The other side effect was the IRS, shortly after the Weisbart case was issued an action on decision, which is a formal statement of the Chief Counsel's office, that Treasury would no longer argue this position that you had to have it delivered, that the postmark rule did not apply. Now, the reg probably should have been noticed by counsel for the taxpayer, because it's a simple, and by the way, if they're represented by a CPA or EA, that's also something you always should do. We should check the reg. If you check the reg, yes, they're sometimes out of date. But services almost always tell you when the reg was last updated. You can find out from IRS history when the code section was last changed. And you find out that this code section has not been changed since the reg was last updated. The reg was last updated in 2001. And this reg clearly says that you can use a postmark on a late filed return. And I'll say most of the services like RIA and I believe CCH, they both at the top of a reg will tell you if it hasn't been updated for a law, you know, if there have been laws passed since this reg was in Atwood, since reg was last modified, and they've not updated for that, you'll be warned about that. So if you looked in there, you would have found this reg, found the answer, and been done very quickly. But the flip side of that is, now the Department of Justice, IRS attorneys found all these cases, right? They did all this research. They miss Weisbart. Okay. That I can kind of understand, because it's always fun finding cases. You're using a research service and trying the best you can to find them. And okay, they missed it. But Department of Justice didn't. That was admitted in their filings. But the problem with the Department of Justice was they didn't go back and check their citators. The RIA citator second very clearly references this action on decision. And by the way, almost every service will tell you if a case is one that the IRS has acquiesced on. And yeah, acquiescence is in all the cites here. But secondly, the citator second also made it very clear that the IRS had published a regulation citing this case, which would have taken you directly to this reg 301-7502-1F, which would have told you right off what the answer was. And the preamble to the reg, which has a citation to this case, makes it very clear they are following Weisbart. In essence, Weisbart does apply in the Seventh Circuit. And had they looked, they would have noticed that, in theory, they're taking a position that Treasury has already said we're not going to take, and that the reg cuts off. So because of that, they asked for a reconsideration of the decision. The taxpayer did. Now, we discovered later that the taxpayer was actually contacted by at least one outside attorney who told them about, hey, guys, this thing was decided wrong. Because, you know, these cases get published, and people who, you know, have worked in the area read the case and go, wait a minute, that's not right. There's a reg that says just the opposite. Contacted counsel for the taxpayer, said you need to file a motion for reconsideration. There is something absolutely that decides this case, that it's clear, it's a reg, it's decided wrong. They filed the motion for reconsideration. The IRS then files eventually this notice that they're not going to oppose that. Now there, the IRS, the Department of Justice attorneys are trying to explain why it's not really our fault we missed this. And Unfortunately, they got the wrath of the judge when he did, on the 29th of January, rule, go ahead and accept this motion and issue the new judgment and have the taxpayer get the refund. He sort of raked them over the coals for, even if you, you know, the best I could say is that you tried to be, barely ethical by just playing to win and not telling me about this case. And he said, secondly, as you looked at the case, you found it would have cite regs, which then doesn't matter. Even if the case doesn't apply in this circuit, the regs do. You told me that the case law was unanimous this way. Obviously, you knew by the time he got here it wasn't. And finally, your reason for not telling me is because this case wouldn't be binding in the Seventh Circuit, but you cited cases from other circuits that also wouldn't be binding in the Seventh Circuit when they were came out in your favor. So to say the judge was upset is minor, is kind of like very, very, shall we say, that's an understatement. He's upset about this because to the judge it's a bit of an embarrassment that he has to go back out and take back his decision. You know, he relied upon these parties to give him the law and they failed him, right? Didn't happen. But the good news for the taxpayer is they're getting the money back. The bad news is they went through an entire process that was probably 98% unnecessary. Now, part of it's their own fault because they waited this long and they got so close to the statute that the taxpayer has to share a big chunk of this blame as to why this issue ever even came up. So taxpayer's not off. But had this rate, if this rate had been noticed, you probably would have shut down the process, just like happened. As soon as this reg came to the notice of all parties, everything finished, the refund was paid. Make sure, I realize that we're all under pressure. We have things to do. When we're doing tax research, we find something we think that's in favor of us, and we have a tendency of stopping. Be careful, don't do that. Again, in this case, had anybody just done the very simple rule of going from the code, check the regs to make sure there's nothing contrary to your position there, or you know about if there is. Because again, you might not follow the regs. You may argue the regs are wrong, but you need to know what they are. And also, when you talk about cases, go to your citator. Follow the case in the citator. See if they lead you to something. The citator can first tell you if the case has been followed. And you'll find out that this case, Weisbart case, had been followed in a lot of other cases. So you really don't want to dismiss it too quickly. And secondly, at least in the RIA citator second, you also get, well, the references to the action on decision, that'll be in all of them for the most part. But they told you when it got referenced in, they'll type it referenced in revenue rulings, revenue procedures, actions, you know, actions on decisions, or in this case, new regulations when they're referenced in the preamble. So yeah, this case never should have made it to court. It never should have made it past probably one letter of protest back to the IRS when they told you first we're not going to pay. That should have been where we could have stopped this thing very early on. So, unfortunately, fortunately the taxpayer gets his refund. Unfortunately, the taxpayer's got to pay legal fees because, by the way, the court did decide that the IRS, the Treasury conduct was not, they were negligent, but they didn't have bad faith. And so because of that, he did not award legal fees. He decided against an award of legal fees. So the taxpayer is still on the hook for all the fees for doing this. And we'll have to see how all that works out. That's between the taxpayer and counsel and, you know, whoever represented them as to, you know, who's responsible for the fact that we're kind of, you know, out a bunch of money in representation. My guess is they probably spent at least the $7,000 in contesting the case. Again, as CPE time is closing up, start planning for next year, though. Keep your eye open. When your state society calendars start opening up, we do have dates already booked for next year. I'm already down for a number of dates. Won't say anything about them until the states themselves release them because it's theirs to release, not mine. So we'll be going there. But we're doing those. Look at those dates. If you do want us to do any sessions in your firm this year, we do those. I do those sessions, but you need to contact us now before dates are locked up. If you wait until October, you know, let's say, or even if you wait until June or July to ask us, you're going to find your choices are going to be a lot more restricted than if you contact us now. Just like you who want to hold your updates and, you know, your tax discussions with your staff and your training in, let's say, the November, December timeframe, state societies want to book dates that time frame too. Again, it's first come, first serve. So if you're looking to book us during that time frame, Now's the time to contact us. And for those of you who aren't looking at that and going to be using state societies, keep your eye out. States will begin posting dates on their websites. Make your plans. Take a look at what you'd like to get involved in for the coming year and make sure you sign up. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. You can follow our updates all during the week at our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. On Twitter, I basically post under Ed Zollers, at Ed Zollers on Twitter. I will post there things as they happen during the week. I'll post a few comments on tax issues. We'll try to retweet some stuff I think might be of general interest, like Glenn Birnbaum's discussions or all of his posts about forms as they've been released, so you have an idea of what's just been released by the IRS, which is useful for your timing purposes. Like when are we going to discover, when is UltraTax going to have this form for filing? They obviously can't have this form for filing. The IRS releases it, so it's nice to know that. Also, I do follow discussions on the subreddit of /r/taxbros on Reddit. You can also follow me. I pay attention to the Tax Talk discussion group for CalCPA, which is open to CPAs and attorneys from across the country. Finally, I also follow the discussion groups in the Connect groups for the CPA societies for Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey. So if you post questions there and I think I can be of use, I will try to respond there. So, follow along there. Those are really useful resources, by the way. If you have access to a similar resource in your state society, it's a really good place to be able to discuss with other accountants who are in the same boat as you the types of issues you run into. So it's a really good resource. With that, we'll be back next week. We'll see what happens during that week. See if we have any developments. Again, on the 4th, OIRA has the meeting, the last one they currently have scheduled, to go over the 163J regs. So we'll be watching for those final regs at some point. We'll take a look, see what else happens, and we'll be back here with you next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.